listening to the only daily talk show in North America covering the world of football. This is World Football Daily.
Yes, 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 yes! It hits the back of the net! Oh my goodness me!
The world's game.
Oh, you're beautiful! What a headshot! What a head!
Our religion.
Brilliant goal! What an equalizer!
Our passion.
Go, go, USA! Oh, it's incredible! You could not write a script like this!
World Football Daily serves up the best football talk 5 days a week.
Oh! You will never, ever see a game quite like this! Unbelievable!
Disaster at the Hawthorns. They may have got a point last night, but there's plenty of problems off the pitch for Pepe Mel and his new side as Nicholas Anelka plays and their main sponsor looks to leave the club. Frank Ribery's been telling it like it is. We have a look at what the Frenchman has finally had to say about the Ballon d'Or and the FIFA World 11. And the Camp Nou is getting a makeover, and there's great action coming from the Coppa Italia tonight. We take a look at the big games coming up this evening, including Manchester City taking on West Ham. But can Sam Allardyce's men really pull down a 6-goal difference from the first leg? I don't think so. Welcome to Tuesday's edition of World Football Daily. I'm Oliver the Deuce Wilson, bringing you the news and some of the views from around the world of football. We're going to have a great guest coming your way later on. Jonathan Liu from The Telegraph will be joining us to talk all things English football. Plenty to talk about from last night and going into tonight and the midweek games in general this week. David Moyes needs to win and turn things around against Sunderland this weekend, this midweek in the Capital One Cup semi-final second leg. That's tomorrow night. Tonight, Manchester City take on West Ham. A 6-goal thumping, remember, was what West Ham had handed to them at the Etihad last week. And now it's 2 weeks ago, should I say, and now it's the role reversal down at Upton Park. Can the Hammers pull round a 6-goal turnaround? I do not think so at this moment in time. There is no chance that Storming City are going to get beaten by West Ham tonight. Not even a loss in general, let alone turning things around and grabbing 6 or even 7 to take themselves through to the Capital One Cup final at Wembley. There's plenty to get into today here on World Football Daily. Loads of good news coming out from the beautiful game that we call football, and there's plenty to get into, including Mr. Champagne. Oh, it starts his presidential candidacy. We'll be getting into that a little later on. Also going to have a look at the Coppa Italia that's taking place tomorrow night, and tonight Roma take on Juventus this evening. We'll be talking about that tomorrow in detail and previewing the big games coming up as well. I want to kick off with a few bits and bobs. First and foremost, Juan Mata to Manchester United. A rumoured £40 million deal could be in the making for the out-of-favour Chelsea man. Is Juan Mata worth £40 million, and is he worth that amount of money in general? It is becoming very apparent to Chelsea fans that Juan Mata does not fit in the plans of Jose Mourinho after making only 11 starts this season, 2 appearances from the bench as well, just 13 appearances in the league this season for Juan Mata, and no goals as well, way off where he was last year. Of course, scored 11 goals last year, Chelsea's player of the season for 2 years in a row. Yet he still can't get in the starting 11 of Jose Mourinho's side. He's been sat on the bench 10 times this year. Unbelievable to think that about somebody, as I say, who has been a standout player for Chelsea for the last 2 years. But could this be the revival that United need if they are willing to go and spend big money to get Juan Mata? £40 million, as I say, being the price tag that's been put on the Spanish man's head. Is he the magician to pull something out of the hat and get United into the Champions League come next year? Or will he be just another attacking midfielder in a place where they've got plenty of depth already, and actually they need to go and fill holes elsewhere in that United side, in that back four and in the heart
in the centre of that midfield, rather than just looking at goals, goals, goals. Well, I tell you what, David Moyes will be pleased to see that Robin van Persie and Wayne Rooney are making their comebacks, starting to get back into the swing of things. Van Persie apparently just around the corner from being able to play again after being left out and on the sidelines with injuries the last few weeks. And of course, Wayne Rooney as well, back at Carrington today, almost 100% fit, we're hearing. So he should be playing a part against Sunderland tomorrow night. And David Moyes would love to turn things around against the Black Cats. They trailed 2-1 after that first leg going back to Old Trafford. And I'm sure getting United in the Capital One Cup final would be a huge bonus, although it's likely they're going to take on Manchester City, and that is not a battle I think that they can win. But would Mata fill the void at United? I'm sure he would be a great player, but when we've already seen the likes of Kagawa be in and out of that side, when they continue to put in people like Giggs, like Fellaini, that aren't good enough and give away the ball far too easily, and when you think that Rooney's got to fit in there with Van Persie as well, Mata out on the flanks, would that work? Would that give him almost a free roaming role? He's not really an out-and-out winger, is he? He's not like a Valencia, who's somebody that will get down that flank and piling crosses. Mata, very much a creative spark, given a free roam. And you just wonder if there's too many cooks spoiling the broth there at United already. Would love to know your thoughts on Wan Mata and a possible move to Manchester United. Let us know. Show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter. 310-909-8483 is the rant line. And of course, you can find us on the Facebook page as well. Roma have been busy this January. Their spending continues as they bring Michel Bastos on loan into the club, with the possibility of a permanent move come the end of the season, along with Radja Nainggolan. That's another decent signing for Rudy Garcia, who is looking to play Bastos in and around the fullback positions, as well as in the middle of the park as well. Give a young, he's 30 years old, but a versatile player for Roma. And it looks like, according to reports coming out of Italy, that Rudy Garcia is starting to build a side with plenty of depth. It's what he wants at the moment. He wants depth and quality depth to be able to secure himself quality play throughout season and league campaign and Champions League campaign for next season. Rudy Garcia looking well into the future, something that some English managers don't do. Could be a very worthwhile pickup indeed. Michel Bastos, the man who's been at a whole host of clubs previously, including Lille and Lyon, very successful in French football, Mr. Bastos, and a good pickup for Roma. We'll be talking about them a little later on in the show. We also need to talk about what's been taking place at the Hawthorns last night. Apparently, West Bromwich Albion knew that their sponsor Zoopla was going to be deserting them had they started Anelka last night. Anelka, of course, has been charged with improper conduct, should I say, by the FA after his Quinella celebration that's so controversial over that Christmas period. And now he's going to face at least a 5-game ban, possibly more. He has until the end of this week to appeal the FA's decision, but it will be a ban for Nicholas Anelka coming his way. We'll keep our ears to the ground and talk about that, I'm sure, later on in the week. We need to get into a little bit of it today, of course, and a look at this Manchester United move, possibly for Wan Mata, and to also take a look at the Capital One Cup semi-finals that are taking place tonight and tomorrow. And there's no better man to have a chat with about these sorts of things than from the Daily Telegraph, a top, top journalist, one of my favourite guys to have a chat with here on World Football Daily, and one of my favourite reads as well. If you ever get on the Telegraph website and have a read of his stuff, it's of course the one, the only, Mr. Jonathan Liu. Jonathan, it's a pleasure to have you on board, mate. Very happy new year. I know it's a bit late for happy new years, as I said yesterday, but I hope you had a very good festive period, mate. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks, Ollie. I'm making some bolognese.
You're making some bolognese. Oh, I'm very envious of you right now. settling, I suppose, for an evening of watching West Ham pull off the miracle comeback against Manchester City, maybe.
Possibly. I mean, I did think about ways in which West Ham could do it. I thought maybe kind of wafting the scent of Chilean food around the around the stadium, or maybe putting pictures of Pellegrini's kids up might make him pine for home a bit and turn the coach round, or possibly in order to benefit Andy Carroll, maybe moving the goal about halfway back into the stands should see him banging them in with regularity. apart from that, I think it might be a tough one for them.
For a second, I didn't know where you were going with that picture of the kids thing. I worried you were going to threaten Pellegrini that I've got your kids, kind of Alan Partridge type thing. But no.
Well, no, he did this in this interview with a Chilean newspaper about over Christmas, I think, where he talked about how he got the way he avoided homesickness was to not look at pictures of his family or to eat Chilean food, and those are the two things he avoided because he has to remain professional and he has to commit fully to his life in Europe. So that's the way in, I think.
I certainly hope that doesn't mean he's just eating fish and chips all day every day just to get with the English tone of thought. It's going to be a very unfit Pellegrini if that continues. He'll be verging on Sam Allardyce's kind of size, I guess, at that point. In all seriousness, though, Jonathan, I mean, West Ham tonight is just playing for pride, but is it really important that West Ham put in a good showing to show they've got some pride left in themselves and in this squad at the moment? Because it's been a really rough Christmas for them.
I think that's all. If you're a West Ham fan and you've paid your 40 quid or whatever, I think they may have cut the prices for tonight's match. But if you pay your money and you go along, you just want to see some pride in the shirt. You want to see them string two passes together. You want to see some kind of very, very early signs that Roger Johnson and James Tompkins are on the same wavelength. You just want to see something to give you optimism for the rest of the season. Because it's around this time that a lot of clubs start, they start sending out season ticket renewals, that kind of thing. And you just want something to inspire you. The weather's horrible. Your team are down in the relegation zone. You're 6-0 down from the first leg. Just give them something to cling on to.
City, on the other hand, are they going to be wanting to just, you know, keep the winning momentum going more than anything else and keep the goals coming in as well? With Barca on the horizon, and I noted Sky Sports last night did a 20-minute breakdown of Barca against Manchester City already, and we're a month away from that tie. But with that being so important and looming on the horizon, is it important for them to keep the goals coming and keep this steady flow of big wins?
Yeah, and the intensity, which is the main thing, because if they do have ambitions in all four competitions, as Pellegrini says they do, then it's really important that they get into the habit of playing Saturday, Tuesday, or Saturday, Wednesday with exactly the same intensity, with no let up. And this is the ideal, I guess, this is the ideal petri dish for them. Their away form has been patchy, although they did win quite well at West Ham earlier in the season. But it's one of those games where you can take your foot off the gas if you are so inclined. And it's really, really important they don't do that.
Are you putting the League Cup trophy already in Manchester City's trophy cabinet when you look at the remaining teams? And obviously Manchester United be the one that would stand out as being a competitive rival to Manchester City, and the season they're having, you wouldn't expect it to be a fair battle at Wembley were it those two at the end of the day. Are you giving it to Pellegrini as a first bit of silverware just yet?
I think massive favourite City. And if you look at Pellegrini's record in cup competitions in Spain, it's one of those trophies that he knows that it's the fourth biggest trophy that he's competing in. But I just think the way that Pellegrini has set them up mentally, it will take a huge effort to, even by Manchester United, to topple them at Wembley. They seem to have this winning mentality at the moment.
United need a big effort even tomorrow night just to make sure that they get to Wembley to potentially take on Manchester City. Let's not write West Ham off completely tonight, but it's unlikely they'll get.
Let's write West Ham off. That's one thing we can do. There are very few certainties, but let's do that.
Okay. We will write them off. But for United to take on City at Wembley, they've still got to get past Sunderland and trail off for that first leg. It's a big turnaround being asked for United, because Sunderland could just basically sit and hold themselves deep and try and play for a draw at Old Trafford tomorrow night.
In the old days, and under Ferguson, I guess, you know, and it is still strange referring to them as the old days, you just knew that if United got an early goal, you knew they would get an early goal, and they would steamroller them home. But there's no kind of certainty with that this season. It's quite possible that Sunderland could turn them over again, especially if, like you say, Poyet has got them defending, you know, acceptably, not brilliantly, but acceptably. And it's quite possible that they will pull off a rear guard. And if it gets to the last 10 minutes and it's still 0-0 and or United still need a goal, then that's when we really see the mettle of the mettle of this David Moyes United team.
Would it be a pivotal result for United if they were to come back from behind after that first leg and get through to the League Cup final? Would that be enough to maybe buoy this United side onto bigger and better things this season? Or would it just be, well, you're getting yourselves back on track rather than anything too special?
It depends how they do it, I think. I mean, if they win 4-1, it's a massive statement. If they win with a sort of a 90th minute goal, then all the headlines are about Fergie time, Manchester United recovering their old habit of scoring last minute winners. If for example, Sunderland pull one back, or for example, and United are hanging on in the end, or they have to do it on penalties, then it doesn't quite send out the same message, and you don't quite get the same. I saw one writer referring to it as this indignant sense of entitlement that Ferguson's United always had and Moyes is trying to find.
When it comes to United, obviously Rooney's coming back, making his way back from injury, as is Robin van Persie, which is a big boost for David Moyes. But talk as well of them possibly bringing in Juan Mata from Chelsea for around about £40 million. If they were to bring him in, and it's a big if, would it be filling a big gap, or would it be plugging up a hole that's already filled with plenty of players at United?
It's interesting because the paradox is, if there is a place for Juan Mata in the United team, why is that place not available to Shinji Kagawa? All right, they're different footed and they come in off different flanks, but essentially they would be working the same spaces, looking to play the same balls, and if there is room for Mata, I don't see how there's also room for Kagawa. Because we've seen how United flood that area, that kind of band outside the penalty area, maybe 30, 40 yards out, towards the centre, coming off the front. They flood that area with bodies. Welbeck does his work there. Rooney does a lot of his best work there. And if they are going to sign Mata, it doesn't necessarily follow that the players that they currently have, who play in that area, have much of a future at the club. So
it does seem a little bit peculiar. Is it extortionate as well? £40 million for Juan Mata? It'd be a big, big profit for Chelsea.
I don't know. In the old days, it would have been a freezer full of ice cream, wouldn't it? I find it quite distasteful. So it's almost kind of like otherworldly, like it's monopoly money. Like, 40 million pounds, 37 million, whichever figure you want to be. It's a hell of a lot of money, but Mata is a Champions League winner. He's a World Cup winner and a Euro winner. He's still young. I think he's about 25, and cut that out. If he's actually 23 or 27, cut that out. But he's still young, and he's putatively in the prime of his career. So he's not that much worse than Ozil, who went for more. It seems fair enough in the current climate, which, disclaimer, is crazy.
It's very peculiar indeed. World football's absolutely balmy at the moment anyway. I want to get on to what happened last night and how this is going to affect West Brom. But before we do, there's talk as well, a loose link to Manchester United, this one. Paul Ince has been given the sack by Blackpool. Talk now of Tom Ince possibly going down to Monaco or to Everton. What do you think, as we don't see many English players going abroad to kind of hone their skills, do you think it would be a good idea for Ince to be heading down south, down to the south of France, to test out what it's like playing abroad as opposed to staying in the Premier League the whole of his career, potentially from a jump to Everton and then on?
In principle, it is a good thing for English players to go abroad. I mean, you see it very often, occasionally in newspapers, they'll do a feature on an Englishman and some far-flung outpost abroad. In principle, it's a good thing. They learn different culture, they learn a different style of football, they learn a different way of approaching the game. Whether Monaco is currently the right choice for Tom Ince, I'm not sure. It's a massive league. You have to be expecting that Monaco will be playing Champions League football next season. We've seen a lot of players move to Monaco and not managed to break into the first team. And you wonder whether Tom Ince is one of those players that Monaco can sign because they can. We sort of seen Traore, who did a very good job at Angie, moved there and obviously found his way blocked, and is now looking to move to England on loan. Whether it's the best move for Tom Ince, not sure. Whether it's a decent move in principle, yeah, you would like to see more English players going abroad because it does kind of bring us out of the cold culturally.
Now, Everton, I see the link where I've done here, Manchester United, Tom Ince, now onto Everton, who are linked with him. It's seamless, I think, Jonathan. Everton last night in action. It's more like an Eddie Izzard stand-up comedy sketch at the moment. It's Everton in action last night with West Bromwich Albion, and a huge uproar around Nicolas Anelka because of his celebration down at West Ham over the Christmas period. And it's led to West Bromwich Albion losing their sponsor at the moment, Zoopla, for the end of this season. This is a massive blow for a side, surely, that can't afford to lose £3 million sponsorships just like that. How difficult is Anelka, and to an extent Pepe Mel's decision to play him, start him last night, making it for West Bromwich Albion as a club?
It was fairly brainless of West Brom to handle the whole Anelka situation as they have. I don't think it'll be a massive hit financially. You also have to question Zoopla's motives. For example, let's say that you're an anti-Semite and you go up to Zoopla and say, I want to give you £300,000 for a house. Are they going to turn you away? No, they're not. I mean, it's terrific PR for them. Terminating the contract now rather than at the end of the season would have opened up all kinds of legal minefields, and they've got more free public. I mean, I didn't know what Zoopla did before this, so you have to you really have to question their motives. In terms of the furore, and this is one of those things that I feel fairly strongly about, in the sense that I don't feel as strongly about this as a lot of people would say you should. I didn't know what a quenelle was. Did you know what a quenelle was? And once you take that emotional element out of it, there are people getting offended by it who had no idea what it was, and getting offended in retrospect. And that's what I find slightly difficult to understand. It really it's moralizing on the basis level. And you get all these sort of columnists and commentators and what have you, and people on Twitter essentially moralizing over something they had absolutely no knowledge of before he did it. And that's what I find kind of baffling about the whole thing.
It is peculiar. And now Romelu Lukaku's almost got himself involved in it as well, because he's not backed Nicolas Anelka, but he said he doesn't think Anelka should be banned for the gesture because he thought it was just a kind of an appreciation to a French comedian rather than anything anti-Semitic. And Everton have had to take this interview off their website. I mean, this has a possibility to potentially snowball a bit, with some players have already been caught up in it, with Sami Nasri as well doing it. This isn't just Anelka that's almost participating in this uproar in the Premier League at the moment.
No, and this is so much more complicated than going on Twitter and saying, you're a racist, you're a racist, you're a racist. This is, I mean, we saw what happened when the Euro Under 21 Championship went to Israel in the summer. A whole list, there were doubts about the veracity of the players on the list, but there was a huge depth of feeling against going to Israel that summer, and it didn't turn into mass protests or boycotts that were anticipated, but there was a huge depth of feeling there. And Lukaku he's an intelligent guy, so is Anelka. Like, these guys aren't mindless pinhead racists. So are we going to condemn them for expressing? I mean, you may disagree with the views they hold, but they are sincerely expressed views, and I'm going to wager that Romelu Lukaku and Nicolas Anelka know a good deal more about French politics than most football columnists in this country. So, is it the right timing for him? Probably not. But I think that there's a lot of people who want to rush to judgment, who find it a lot easier to say you're a racist rather than actually thinking about what are we going to do about this. And it's so easy to stand in your pulpit and just shout you're a racist. And it needs to be a maturer discussion than that.
Well, Jonathan, I'm glad you've been able to bring an element of maturity to the discussion around the Quinella this afternoon, and we appreciate you giving us some time to talk about that and, of course, the League Cup semi-finals and Tom Ince as well today, man. We always appreciate you coming on. Look forward to catching up with you very soon indeed, my man. And hopefully we won't have to deal with any sort of Quinella-type story for the rest of this season, but you can never count that with the Premier League, I guess, can you?
Until the next racing scandal, Ollie. Thanks for having me.
Cheers, Jonathan. Take care, mate. Have a very good evening and enjoy the Spag Bowl, mate. Have a good one.
Cheers.
Jonathan Liu there joining us here on World Football Daily, talking to us about the English Premier League and, of course, the Quinella scandal that continues to bubble around West Bromwich Albion. Pepe Mel's decision to play Nicholas Anelka last night, was it smart on West Bromwich Albion's part to put their under pressure and under fire French striker in the middle of this big argument again? An argument that, of course, Nicholas Anelka started with the Quinella jester at West Ham earlier on this season. Big thanks to him as well for taking us through a little bit of the Tom Ince transfer, possibly to Monaco, possibly to Everton. Should English players, much like American players, be trying to get abroad to play some football, to learn a bit of continental style to their game? Is that what we've been lacking in England? Let us know your thoughts. Show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter. 31909-9843 is the rant line, and the Facebook page as well is where you can catch us. But a massive thanks to Jonathan there for joining us. Really, there's something else that's caught my eye today, by the way, because I want to move away from the Premier League just for a moment and talk a little bit about, because I love history, and today we're going to bounce around World Football Daily a bit with some very off-the-wall stories. Not off the wall, but they're just not really much about to do what's going on the pitch at the moment. We'll be tackling a bit of Italian football later on, as I said, as well as a preview to some of the other fixtures this evening. But I do want to talk about, as I say, the presidential run for FIFA. We'll get onto that later. And Barcelona at the Nou Camp. The Nou Camp, one of the most historic grounds on the planet. And if any of you have been there, been to the museum, been to see a game there, you'll know exactly what I mean when I say it is a beautiful grotty ground, in that it's not aesthetically pleasing from the outside in terms of it looking new and pretty, but what it is a beautiful piece of footballing architecture that you point that out. You put a picture of that to a football fan from almost anywhere around the globe, and they'll be able to tell you that is the Camp Nou, because it is unique with that arching side in front of the area with the roof. And they're going to restructure it. They're going to rebuild part of it, and they're going to crack on a nice outer shell. They're going to put in these wonderful new boxes and VIP suites and all that kind of stuff. And they're going to basically do what they did with the Maracanã. They're going to put a big roof all the way around it that covers plenty of the seats, so the execs in their posh chairs don't get wet during Champions League finals, which they'll be hoping to host there once again. And I think it's so sad that we're losing such a traditional part of world football. The football ground, the historic kind of four terraces that you used to get in England, obviously they're going now as they fill in the corners at grounds and try and build these new superstructures, but they all look so generic and so modern. And I think it's such a shame. I really do. I'd love to. I mean, anybody who's been to one of these classic football grounds, the Bernabeu has been able to kind of almost retain its originality and its beautiful look. And it's something that I think needs to be respected at Madrid, because they've built and built on top of that. But and while they have altered the look of it, they've almost managed to kind of keep, as I say, the history. And it doesn't look like a generic modern ground, the Bernabeu. It still looks like something stood apart from the rest of world football. In the same way that Old Trafford, you know, they filled in the corners, but it still has a completely unique look. But then you compare it to things like the Estadio de Lutz and the Emirates, and they do just look identical. These big, boring bowls. You look at a lot of the new stadiums for Brazil this World Cup, and yes, they look great, but they also lack any sort of feature character to them. Whereas in the walls of the Nou Camp, you can, if walls could talk, imagine what those walls would say in terms of the football that they've seen, the fans, the stories, the players that they've seen. It would just be it would be fantastic to listen to their tales, that's for sure. And I just think it's, you know, modernising some of these grounds. You can modernise it to an extent, but when you start taking the character out of them, I think it becomes really sad indeed. And I guess that's going to be my last gripe before we move on here on World Football Daily. I've had a good old moan today, I think, and time to time to move away from a little bit of the moaning and groaning, and time to see what everybody else wants to, everybody else thinks about that. Remember, show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter, 3109983 is the rant line, the Facebook page as well. Big thanks once again there to Jonathan Liu for joining us just a moment ago here on World Football Daily. One of my personal favourites, I think. I don't know if I can speak for the rest of the audience, although I know Jonathan goes down very well with the in the World Football Daily mixture, so to speak. But I do think I do always enjoy a good chat with Johnny Liu, and very, very friendly as well. I wish we could put some of the off-air stuff on that we that we talk about, because you can kind of bounce around with some really weird stuff with him as well when we're off air. But lovely, a lovely chap indeed, Johnny Liu. That giggling in the background signifies one thing and one thing only, and that does mean that Rafa is joining me here today on Tuesday's edition of WFD, trying to stay secret and secluded. But I tell you what, he is no ninja. He always crops up at this time on World Football Daily. It's not like it's unexpected at all. Rafa, mate, how are you doing today?
I'm well, man. I'm well. And Johnny Liu's funny. I mean, the great thing about all of our guests is that they're all just kind of different, you know, and they all have their own personalities, and every kind of off-air banter that we have. I mean, think of Graham Hunter. Think of Kristen Hennage. Just off the top of my head, I'm thinking of a Catholic school, you know, just, yeah, okay. Catholic school and rap music.
It's
a long story.
It's off air for a reason. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it's off air for a reason. But love the family of World Football Daily, and welcome to those new members who are joining us, actually, and those members who are staying with us. It is that kind of time of season, Juice, where we get our kind of annual membership kind of surge from all of you guys. And it just shows us every year that there are, you know, hundreds of you guys out there who are really just as into this game as we are, Juice. And it keeps me motivated on a general basis to kind of keep watching soccer and kind of talk with my friends, which is really what I do every day. And I absolutely love it, guys. So thank you very much.
I'm just an opinionated ass, so I quite like to just be able to talk into a microphone and hope that people are listening and judging my comments left, right and centre. No, it's always a big thanks to those guys who join us here on World Football Daily to chat with us, whether it is you, the viewer, or stroke listener, or even our extra special guests as well who join us every day here on the show. Raph, we were talking...
I like the use of that, stroke listener. That was clever. Yeah. Well, slash. I use slash.
Viewer, stroke, listener, stroke, reader. Because I guess we obviously have the Kickabout blog with Gio as well. But I want to get into... We were talking yesterday. I think we touched on Richard Sherman for a second. His rant after the Seahawks game, which has just gone, you know, completely viral. We're still talking about it today in the news, on Bleacher Report, on all of those good places to get your kind of NFL news going. I was commenting to some people yesterday. I was saying, God, you know, wouldn't it be great to have somebody like that come out in football? You know, wouldn't you love to see Jack Wilshere say you got United against Arsenal, and Fellaini beforehand makes a few comments about how he's going to boss that midfield and this is going to be his game to step up and boss it. And wouldn't you love, say, Jack Wilshere to come out after a game, say Arsenal beat United, say Wilshere's had a stellar performance and has controlled the heart of the midfield, and for him to come out, not to be so kind of in-your-face brash, but to say, hey, you know what, there was a lot of talk about Fellaini going into this game, but we controlled that midfield. I distributed and dominated that heart of that midfield. And I tell you what, you can talk about Fellaini all you want, but when it came down to it today, Arsenal and Jack Wilshere ran the show today. Just something like that. Nothing overly aggressive or any kind of in your face, nothing to prompt the similar look of Aaron Andrews gave Sherman the other night, which was this real patronite. When he said, "I'm the best corner of all time," she kind of looked down into her shoulder a bit, just like, "Oh, here we go," as knowing exactly what was going to happen. Nothing to promote that sort of reaction from, say, somebody like Jeff Shreves, but in the same way, just kind of giving that sort of chat back to in a footballing British sense, so to speak. I would love something like that to happen. I was saying that yesterday, and lo and behold, what happened? Oh, joy of joys. Frank Ribery, our saviour, our knight in shining armour. Frank Ribery coming out after being the third place runner-up in Ballon d'Or voting for 2013. Yeah. Ribery comes out and slams FIFA, slams the World 11 choices. Oh, it's just music to my ears, and rightfully so, to an extent, when you listen to what he's got to say. He said, "I won everything I could win with Bayern and individually. Ronaldo, on the other hand, did not win anything. I'm not sad that I missed out, but it does hurt a bit. I deserve to win the Ballon d'Or." Great. Great line from Frank. But it doesn't end there from the Frenchman. Oh, no, he wasn't done with that. It was clear that Ronaldo would win it. The voting deadline was extended by 2 weeks. This had never happened before. It wasn't about football. It was a political decision. Oh, Frank, you're bringing out so many choice lines here. The world's press are loving you right now. And he still continued. There are only three Bayern players in there. He's talking about the FIFA World 11. That's madness. Thomas Müller deserved to be there, and so did David Alaba and Bastian Schweinsteiger and Arjen Robben. We won five titles and made history. And then there's the absence of Borussia Dortmund players. Where are Mario Götze and Robert Lewandowski? This is impossible. I mean, even to go as far to say that FIFA overlooking not just Bayern, but even Bayern's biggest rivals, Borussia Dortmund, shows almost a solidarity from Frank Ribery and German football to say, wait a minute, what went on with the Ballon d'Or and the FIFA World 11? I mean, for Ribery to come out and say, I should have won the Ballon d'Or, that is a big statement to make. And there aren't many people that have kind of come back at him and said, hold on, Ronaldo was the better player. Now, the World 11 thing, I think we can all agree that there should have been more Bundesliga players.
Is this the typical pointing at the scoreboard and just saying scoreboard, buddy? I mean that's kind of what I'm getting from.
What like the you're talking trust me all day, but look at what is up there. Look, five titles. Buddy, what did you win? Yeah.
I should have won.
It's the equivalent of walking up and just saying, "Hey, Ronaldo, show me your medals from 2013. Where are all your medals? Oh, that's right. You didn't win a medal because we won all of them, apart from the Europa League, which we don't even care about because we won the Champions League. So hail at me now." I mean, it really is a big bold statement coming out from Ribery. I completely agree with him with the World 11. The Ballon d'Or vote, it's still very difficult. The 2 week voting extension, you know, that obviously helped Ronaldo. I don't think anybody can argue against that. I'm sure that was done.
So it added that international competition, which was obviously, you know, a masterclass showcase.
But there's also the fact that when you look at how are you voting on the Ballon d'Or? Are you voting it because of a person that wins trophies as part of a team, or are you looking at it on the individual basis? Because those are two big different factors. Because you could look at Ronaldo and say there were plenty of people around him in that Madrid team that didn't perform up to standard as those Bayern players did. And Ribery was therefore helped by those Bayern players in winning those medals. But you can also look at it and say on an individual basis that Ribery was still fantastic, but as an individual was Ronaldo better and just hindered by the lack of teammates around him that reached the same kind of feats and pinnacle as those Bayern players did around Ribery. It all depends on how you're going to vote for it. I think if you are voting for it on a completely individual solo footballing basis, Ronaldo's the out and out winner. If you are including medals and team wins and showing your trophy cabinet at the end of the season, then Ribery has to go in there because he was the outstanding player in an outstanding and history making Bayern Munich side. This debate could rumble on for a very long time. But I just love the fact that Ribery has come out rather than you did kind of think he was stood there in third place and just kind of like, look at this same old two. I mean, it was the same old two,
right.
1-2 and whoever wants to come third. Great. Well done. And you know, it's not going to mean anything to Ribery really being that third place. No one remembers third place. Especially everybody only remembers second place because it's the one that isn't Ronaldo or the one that isn't Messi, you know, whoever wins it type thing. So, nobody will remember Ribery in third place in probably like 20 years' time or so. What they will remember is a Bayern Munich side that absolutely dominated football over 2013. And Ribery is an outstanding player in that. And I think time will tell when people look back. And I think there will be a big reflection in hindsight of whether the right decision was made with that Ballon d'Or vote. I still think Ronaldo deserved it. But I think there was also should have been plenty more Bayern players in that start.
Well, you know, for me, Juice, like you said, I kind of see it from the perspective as who was the best individual footballer out there. And that doesn't necessarily mean how many titles did he win, you know, and how successful his club and country were. I think it does kind of, you know, hinge a little bit on how much he can kind of lift up those teams. But yeah, and definitely success helps. But For me, I'm with you. I think, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo was the best footballer of the last year. So, but poor Frank. And again, I hate to agree with you, but thank you for kind of standing up and saying something, because it does mean something to the fans. We appreciate you. If for nothing else, we will remember you for standing up and saying something about this Ballon d'Or.
Rather than sitting back and just kind of going, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Applying the usual media stream of, oh, yeah, no, it's just a great honour to be involved in the part of it. And, oh, you know, they're exceptional players. And, oh, wouldn't it be great to play with them as all a big one team? And, oh, yeah, wouldn't it be? No, none of that. Coming out and standing up for what he really believed in. Frank Ribéry there saying that he feels he should have won the Ballon d'Or. There is so much to get through, Raf, and a lot of it about off-the-pitch stuff as well. The next topic I want to bring up with you today comes from FIFA and the presidential candidate races. Jerome Champagne. What a great name that would be to be leading the World Footballing Organization. Mr. Champagne, obviously Mr. Champagne has to win this. But coming out yesterday and talking about his presidential candidacy bid for FIFA's presidential role, and talking about what is in his manifesto, so to speak, for the presidential run. Now, the voting will take place in June 2015, so we've got a long time yet. I mean, this is almost building up as big as a US presidential race, you know, kind of 18 months in advance. Now the campaign starts to get rolling. But remember, this is just for FIFA. This isn't like we're going to be control of a country, although FIFA operates within its own boundaries outside of kind of country's laws, so to speak, in the world. So maybe there is, maybe you are almost as, it's
there's
almost
a certain sovereignty to the FIFA nation.
Yeah, it's almost like being the leader of your own country, the way you could run FIFA. But let's put that aside for the moment and look at what is in the proposal for Mr. Champagne. He says he wants quotas for foreign players, probably a good idea. He wants to implement rugby's rule, where only the captain can talk to the referee with a free kick being advanced 10 yards if there's any dissent. Now, love this rule. I mean, the period of adjustment would just be disastrous for so many football teams when we see players kind of crowding around a referee and stuff like that. Imagine if you got a cynical trip at the halfway line, and maybe you're at Old Trafford and United players go straight up into the face of the referee. Now, you could have four or five United players around that referee all talking to him that aren't the captain. So that's about 50 yards in penalty yards that you'd then have to add on. You'd be putting the ball in an indirect free kick inside the 18-yard box suddenly.
I was just thinking, I didn't even think about the multiple players kind of in the face, but I mean, if they do kind of tack on, you know, 10 yards per player, that could get interesting very quickly.
It should be optional as well, though, because you could say have a free kick 25 yards out. It gets moved to right to the edge of the 18-yard box, and suddenly that's a lot harder to get up and over a wall and back down again. So it should be an optional whether, you know, how far you want it moved forward, whether you want it the full 10 yards.
I would only
like
three penalties on the five penalty call, please, sir.
Yeah, I will take the three. We'll put another 20 yards. We'll take those other two tens and put them on the next free kick. We'll do that one. God, that'd be no referee would be able to keep up with that. But you know, it's a good idea though. I like that. I'm a big fan of the captains only talking to the referee, because it adds a level of discipline, and it will hopefully stop those kind of scenarios where you see players surrounding a referee and yelling in his face and horrible stuff like that. He wants to abolish the triple punishment rule, where a player who prevents a goal-scoring opportunity in the penalty area concedes a penalty kick, is sent off, and is also suspended. He thinks that is OTT. I'm not so sure about that, because goals change games. And if you stop a goal-scoring opportunity in the penalty area, you deserve to be sent off, and the other team deserves that penalty kick, because you have changed the game drastically if they miss it. So the advantage has to be played to that scene. But again, it's a novel idea. It's a new idea. All FIFA presidential candidates taking part in live debates on television and in front of the six continental confederations. Now, I said this wasn't a bloody US presidential run, but we're getting into those borders, aren't we? Having televised free FIFA presidential candidates taking part in live debates on TV in front of the continental confederations. I mean, Yeah, okay, I like it. Again, I like the idea. I like the idea. Maybe you get a Twitter vote going in as well or something like that, you know. You know, like a hashtag FIFA presidential question, and then you can fire questions out via Twitter. And so, I don't know. Who knows? And making public the salary of the FIFA president and leading officials. That is important, I think, because I think I think it would just bring FIFA back to reality with the public. And, I mean, sure, if there's an outcry about the amount of money being spent on paying these guys, it probably wouldn't do anything. Nothing would happen. FIFA operates within its own laws, but it would still just be able to kind of, you'd be able to look and relate to it in some way, shape or form, rather than just knowing that Sepp Blatter makes a fortune. It'd be nice to know how much of a fortune he makes, and then you can kind of campaign and I suppose add a bit more backing almost to your own outcry at Sepp Blatter and some of the things that he's maybe done or said, especially when you can then say, and he's being paid exactly this. We know he's getting paid this plus bonus, etc. The big one, though, that Mr. Champagne is talking about is orange cards for sin-binning players midway through a game. If it's not a yellow, it's not a red, sin-bin a player for about 5 to 7 minutes or so. I have a problem with this idea. It's obviously something that comes from rugby, but I do have a problem with this idea. One, because is a player on a yellow card, is that worse than getting sin-binned? Because if you're sin-binned,
Are two sin-bin cards a yellow?
Well, apparently it would be yellow, orange, red. But that would surely... I don't understand that, because what if it was a straight sin-bin? That surely isn't as bad. A team could hold on for 5 minutes with down to 10 men. And surely it would be, if you got an orange, you would also have a yellow card to your name as well, so you couldn't do it again. I would have thought two oranges would mean sending off rather than... You know, you get sin-binned once and a yellow card, or you get sent off.
It complicates a very simple and beautiful game. Plus, and it adds an extra kind of layer of, you know, interpretation
we're nowhere near close enough in being able to interpret yellow and red cards just at this moment in time. I mean, you look at Raphael the other night against Manchester United. Mm-hmm. But I also think for a referee, you know, if in the spur of the moment he wants to do the quick pull the card out of the top pocket and show it, and you know, naturally goes there for his red card. Top pocket, there we go, boom. Very quick. This orange would have to be very distinguishable from the yellow and the red. If I was going to put in another card, I would not... I mean, it would look ridiculous having a purple card or a green card or something like that. But, and I suppose there'd be plenty of people when they play the US looking to get a green card during that game. But I'm sure it would make a lot more sense for it to not be orange. The middle combination of yellow and red. So in the heat of the moment, the referee doesn't inadvertently pull out the orange instead of a red. And you don't say that these kind of things wouldn't happen, because can I remind you that Graham Poll gave out 3 yellow cards to one player in a World Cup game? Let's not beat around the bush here. Stupid things can happen in football. And if you inadvertently show the wrong card, could get the referee in a whole heap of trouble. It's unnecessary to have this sin-binning rule. Yellow and red cards, leave it at that, and just work out what you want those cards to be kind of the equivalent for. Two-footed challenges, jumping in, that's a red card, that's not a yellow. You know, niggly little fouls. Is a professional foul one where you intentionally bring somebody down? Is a professional foul therefore a sending off? Therefore, those fouls and free kicks at the halfway line when somebody's breaking away, leading a counter-attack, and a player comes across and gives a cynical foul, brings the guy down, but it's just a small trip. Is that not a red card rather than a yellow? Because although the ferociousness of that challenge isn't there, it's an intentional foul. An intentional foul surely is a red card. You're not meant to go around intentionally fouling people. I'd love to know people's thoughts on this idea. We put a tweet out to this link earlier on in the day. It's on the Facebook page as well. Give us some comments. Let us know. Show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter. 310-909-8483 is the rant line. And of course, the Facebook page as well. Orange card, sin binning. Does it work in football? We've already had one response actually today to it. And it's not a popular response for the orange sin binning. Mark Biram says, can't see it happening. Ambiguities of red, yellow system create plenty enough controversy and arbitrary justice. I think I have to agree with you there, Mark. But let us know if you think sin binning would work in football. Let us know. Show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter. 310-909-8483 is the rant line. And, of course, the Facebook page as well. We have to preview a bit of Roma against Juventus. That's coming up in just a minute. But the final thing, I spoke about it at the beginning of the show, Raf. I want to hear your thoughts on it, because the remodelling of the Camp Nou.
Mm-hmm.
Yay or nay?
Well, no. I mean, I never really expected Barcelona to actually go and build a new stadium. I feel like there's just too much history at the Camp Nou, and you can kind of modernize stadiums with while keeping.
Yeah, but you've seen what they're going to do with it. It looks nothing like the Camp Nou. It's an abomination of the place. I love the iconic kind of ground that is the Camp Nou. I'm a huge fan of the one roof over, you know, one.
It keeps its shape. I mean, it still keeps its general structure.
They add another bloody layer on top all around the ground. So now, rather than it being this beautiful kind of curved arc going up and then back down it, it's suddenly a bowl. They're going to put a roof all the way around it, which will be the same all the way around, making it more like a bowl. They're going to put this weird outer shell around it, so that kind of grimy, raw authenticness of the ground is suddenly turned into a nice, cosmic, kind of shiny, commercial...
Purple, orange, red, it's got the Catalonian colors in it. I'm just saying. And there is, okay, I see the bowl that you're talking about, but there is still that kind of high side on it.
Dude, it's the same all the way around. It's the same label all the way around on that.
No. I'm looking at it right now, Juice. I had to re-look at it just to make sure that we're talking about the same thing. I see that one side is higher and that it does keep some of that old familiar
shape. Where is it higher? Are we looking both at the picture that was released on Barca's official Twitter feed?
I'll have to check that.
With the roof all the way around, the kind of glassy-looking roof all the way around, and you've got one tier...
Like tiles on the outside, right?
No. That's a very weird artist impression. These are the stills, and we've put the video up on worldfootballdaily.com as well. The press conference that was really that came out yesterday of the proposed design of and it's just an abomination of what that football ground, because, and as I said earlier in the show, what I love about the Nou Camp is that it is not a beautiful, picturesque ground in the same way the San Siro isn't beautiful, shiny, brand new. You know, it's lots of areas are just horrible concrete inside the ground. It's not brand new kind of seats, extra leg room and all this rubbish. It is a traditional kind of 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s football ground. And it has the feel of an 80s, 70s, 60s, 90s football ground. And not only that, it holds the history still of those teams, of Milan, of Barca, respectively. Of those games, those iconic moments in football. You tell any Manchester United fan who goes to that new Camp Nou when development finishes around about 2021 and they're expecting begins 2017, ask anybody, would they go and be there for that night of Champions League final action against Bayern Munich, or would they rather be in the old Camp Nou with its history, with that kind of grimy feel to it, but that authentic football ground feel? Which one they'd rather take? And I am
looking at the at the current picture that is tweeted out by FC Barcelona, and I still think it looks like one side has maybe more seats. I could be well off. I haven't seen the video yet, but
I wouldn't take the time to watch the whole video. It's about an hour long, kind of, you know, flick through bits and bobs. But the images that have been released, the planning images, I mean, they're going to build this new kind of complex almost around the Camp Nou.
Right.
And one of the great things about the Camp Nou, anybody that's...
I think it does keep the interior feel. I mean, obviously there is a sort of like a lip over the stadium. It doesn't kind of, it's not a dome by any means, but... I do think you do feel a little bit of that historical Camp Nou. You're going to be sitting in the same bowl. I like it. It's modernizing it and bringing it up to date while holding on to the past a little bit for me, but at least.
They're going to do all this work for 7,000 extra seats, yet The thing I noticed in the press release is that they're also adding in, by the way, not just 7,000 new seats, but there will be new restaurants with a view of the pitch, a so-called super boxes, and other VIP services. And this is the reason why it's being done, though. It's being done so it can host Champions League finals again and things like that, and be up to date with things like the new Wembley, which is also a horrible stadium. I want to go to football in... I don't mind. Look, some new grounds are fantastic. You look at the Allianz Arena as a football viewing ground, you know, how steep it is. It's a beautiful place to watch football in. But I still don't think it's got the charm and the uniqueness of the old kind of stadium in the Olympic Park in Munich. In the same way, this ground is so iconic in the way that side on kind of lips up above the rest of the ground, how it's only got a roof on one side, and it looks so grimy from the outside, yet you know inside it's a palace of football, it's a cathedral of what makes football fantastic. And now it's going to just be kind of glossed over. It's going to have a nice plastic sheen put over it, and it's going to be considered, you know, a FIFA worthy as opposed to a football tradition worthy ground. That's what kind of grinds my gears a bit, Raph. I love seeing games in those old stadiums. That's why I love Hillsborough so much, because it's not just the home of my team, but because it's barely changed over the years in terms of how the ground looks. Renovate it on the inside if you need to. Put extra boxes in and stuff like that, but don't get rid of the beautiful kind of architecture of these iconic football grounds, because you're stripping away a part of football history. That's all I'm saying, Raph. That's all I'm saying.
Preach it, brother. What do you have to say about tonight's Italian super matchup?
Super Italian. Wow, that sounded very kind of like Japanese cartoony type thing. Italian super matchup.
Super matchup.
tonight, I don't see it going too well for Roma. Yeah. I think Juve would quite like a Coppa Italia, especially a big win over mentally. This could be big in terms of they battered Roma 3-0 at the start of January, and to do it again so soon after in another big competition, I think would be a big mental reach over Roma in terms of the title race this year. I don't know if Roma would be able to come back from that, of knowing it would almost guarantee the fact that Roma aren't as good as Juventus. So when they meet again in May, at the end of the season, you know, Juventus will have already wrapped up the title by then. It's in Rome. It's going to be very tough indeed in the Stadio Olimpico, of course. But that 3-0 win, as I said last time, and Juventus, aside from a Serie A win last year for Roma against Juventus, the three ties before that, which have all been in Turin, of course, have been big wins for Juve, 4-1, 4-0, and 3-0 the last time they met in the Coppa Italia, which was almost 2 years ago to the date. Tuesday the 24th of January was the last time they met at this stage in the Coppa Italia. A 3-0 win for Juventus that night. I don't think it will be as convincing, but I think Juve will get it done with a cheeky 2-1 win, especially with Bradley gone, and with, as we were talking yesterday on the show, Pjanic, his kind of future up in the air possibly as well. It's a little bit of uncertainty around Roma, and I still think they want a solid striker as well. I think that's one thing Roma might miss, is that if they had somebody, like obviously everybody wants a Lewandowski or something like that, but if they had that sort of a striker, the kind of guaranteed 20-25 goals a season, you know, that rare breed, but still very, there are those players about, I think that would help tip them over the edge for being able to compete with Juventus in terms of firepower, because that midfield's still very strong, and sure, the back line has improved from last season as well, but I just think they're missing that.
I see a 3-1 match only because I think, you know, I think Roma gets pretty much a consolation goal. And I do think Juventus kind of controls this match through and through. And this kind of, like you said, just sets the groundwork for the rest of the season to let everybody else know that it is their title. And yeah, I think you're right. I think they will have a little bit of this Coppa Italia title as well. They'll take that too, since they're at it.
Conte's building a legacy here, isn't he? I mean, he's stamping his name on Juventus as a club, as a manager. I think he wants to just win everything he can. And I think if he gets a League and Cup double this year, then the Champions League becomes
It puts a lot of pressure on Champions League expectations.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. But it also, I think he obviously wants to rise to those expectations. It was a rough year last year. This year. Last year wasn't much better in the Champions League, although I did feel Juventus could have gone further. But I think that's the next step. If they get the League and Cup double, 3 Serie A titles in a row, it will be Champions League football or bust next season for Juventus, which might be better for Serie A as well, with Roma, Napoli, Fiorentina, Inter to an extent, and of course, maybe, possibly, very rarely, AC Milan. Providing some performances as well in Serie A. Talking of Inter, there's plenty of disruption around Eric Tohir. People want to see him stop talking about business and start putting money into the football team. We'll get into that as well tomorrow when we have a look back at Roma against Juventus tonight and look ahead to the other Coppa Italia clashes coming up. Milan against Udinese and the Tuscan derby of Fiorentina against Siena. Two of the most beautiful cities you will ever go to, not just in Italy, but probably in the world, and they take on each other. It would be kind of ironic if it turned into like a proper kicking game, like a bloodbath. You've got these two beautiful cities and then their football teams just go kind of hell for leather to kick the living hell out of each other. Unlikely, but we shall see what happens. We'll be talking about that tomorrow on World Football Daily. Enjoy all the football that is coming your way tonight. Of course, we have the French Coupe de France. We've got the Italian Coppa Italia. And of course, the Coppa del Rey continues. Real Madrid against Espanyol and the Capital One Cup as well, as we said earlier. Continuing tonight, can West Ham come back against Manchester City? I don't think so.
I would rather watch the English FA Cup with Oxford United taking on Charlton Athletic.
Hey, I almost caught myself watching that Rangers game from last night. It was actually,
I know.
I started watching the rerun today and I realised what I was doing, and I had to do it. I had to turn off it just so I could tell you that I turned off Rangers in my house.
You missed a good 2-0 away win.
Hey, if you're not going to watch Sheffield Wednesday against Leeds, I'm not going to watch Rangers ever. We'll leave it there for today. A massive thanks to Jonathan Liu once again for joining us here on WFD. I want to talk about boot porn tomorrow, Raf. This was something that you mentioned last week and I want to get into it because I'm back looking at football boots once again. Adidas are releasing a new pair of Copper Mundials this Saturday. We're going to try and get some more information on that. And I'm still hunting down the Zidane golden boots that were apparently never given to him. Or he did wear golden boots in that World Cup, but the special pair that was set to be given to him after his retirement from the game. I'm still trying to find out what happened to those as well. But we will talk about all of that tomorrow, boot porn on World Football Daily, because I just love looking at football boots. I know you do as well, Ref. And of course, we'll be building up all of the big action from this week in midweek. Plenty of football, as I say, coming your way tonight. Enjoy all of it while you can, because it doesn't last long. Thank goodness we've got a World Cup this summer to kind of fill the void this time. We will continue, though, tomorrow on Wednesday's edition of the show. Take care. Enjoy the football. We will see you at the same time. Have a good one.